Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. From the plague to the present-day coronavirus pandemic, disease outbreaks have shaped everything in society, from politics to personal relationships. Frank M. Snowden is the Andrew Downey Orrick Professor Emeritus of History and History of Medicine at Yale University. He studies historical disease outbreaks, their personalities, so to speak, and how they change a society's trajectory, sometimes in profound ways. The paperback edition of his 2019 book, Epidemics in Society, From the Black Death to the Present, includes a new foreword to briefly address the novel coronavirus. Little is still known about the virus and the disease that it causes, but Snowden says that, like all pandemics, COVID-19 is not an accidental or random event. And how we respond to it says more about us than the disease. Frank Snowden, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Frank. Delighted to be with you.
Frank Snowden does join us by Skype, so we might be making some adjustments. Are you there, Professor?
I'm here.
Okay.
You can hear me.
You are calling us, or we're talking to you from Rome, Italy.
That's exactly right. I'm in Rome at the moment.
Working on more research. You write in the preface to the paperback edition that, like all pandemics, COVID-19 is not an accidental or random event. But people seem taken aback by it. Where's the disconnect?
It's not a random event. That I believe that societies create, we live in a world of microbes, and the kind of societies that we create also create channels by which certain types of microbes can adapted to the world, the society that we live in, can actually reach us and be transmitted in our midst. And ways of looking at that would be to say that in the 19th century, during, I'd make a very brief comparison between cholera in the 19th century and COVID virus today. And that is just to explain this point. In the 19th century, Asiatic cholera was able to thrive in a world of the Industrial Revolution because industrialization created huge cities with no sanitary infrastructure, no clean water supplies, no toilets, no safe drinking water, and no paved streets. That was an ideal environment for filth and for diseases transmitted through the contamination of food and water to reach human beings as they consumed contaminated water, ate contaminated produce, and then to spread in our midst person to person and through the drinking water. Now, with sanitary measures that have been taken throughout the industrial world of safe drinking water, sewage systems, our daily hygiene, housing regulations, and all the rest, we're no longer vulnerable to a disease like cholera transmitted in that way. On the other hand, we are vulnerable to diseases transmitted in a different way, diseases, pulmonary diseases transmitted through the air that reach this world that is globally connected. I would define Asiatic cholera as a disease of industrialization and COVID-19 as a disease of globalization of our globalized world in which we're devastating the environment, in which we also have dense cities, and they're connected by mass movement of people by air travel, so that a virus that, say, breaks out in Jakarta, to take a place at random, can, in the morning, can be spread to Los Angeles or Columbus, Ohio, or Rome, Italy, by the evening. And so we're living in a world in which we're under that sort of threat of a disease of that kind. It's in that sense that I regard COVID-19 as a disease of the kind of world that we've created and our relationship with that world.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the history of epidemics in society. That's the title of the book by my guest, Frank Snowden. He's Professor Emeritus of History and History of Medicine at Yale University. His new book, the complete title is Epidemics in Society, From the Black Death to the Present. If you have a question or a comment for Professor Snowden, give us a call, 614-292-8255. 8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Someone made a wisecrack to me a couple weeks ago, and it probably took root differently because I've been reading your book, and that was that most people learned about in the world today learned about the pandemic of 1918 from watching Downton Abbey. The point being that I've read lots of history, although I'm not a historian, but I'm a buff, and I would have to agree that it's always a footnote when it comes to the 1918 pandemic. It's never the Spanish flu or whatever. It's never dealt with as fully as maybe it should have been, right?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And I love your quotation, and it strikes me as profoundly true. The point about the Spanish, in fact, there's the standard history of the American experience of the Spanish influenza is the title of it is America's Forgotten Pandemic. So it really is an event that is extraordinarily affected by human amnesia. Now, there are good reasons for that. One is that unlike, let's say, bubonic plague or Asiatic cholera or indeed COVID-19, those diseases besiege communities for prolonged periods of time. The Spanish influenza, although it's extraordinary in its the total number of people it killed, as many as 100 million people around the world, many more than the First World War itself, it passed through individual communities quite rapidly. That was one factor in why people were able to forget it quickly. But we also have to remember the big context, which is to say that in 1918, we're talking about the First World War. It was overshadowed, let's say, by the First World War, then the peacemaking, the Bolshevik Revolution. These were the events that were on people's minds, and they tended to not be concerned with the disease, especially since it was regarded, oh, it's just the flu, and people seem to think that the flu can't be as deadly as this actually was. And one last factor was that the news about the Spanish influenza in all the belligerent countries was severely censored because governments did not want other belligerent powers, their enemies, to know their vulnerabilities and to the degree to which they were struggling with this particular disease. So the public was not kept informed in a way that it is with COVID-19, which is another factor in the forgetfulness that engulfed the Spanish influenza.
You referenced David Quammen and his 2012 book Spillover, which forecast the next human pandemic. And I talked to him back then, and he was emphatic, of course, and the book was brilliant. But he made the point that spillovers are becoming more and more frequent. Why don't we pay attention?
Oh, this is a real problem. We can see that we're very profligate in our concern for the environment. We see that one could ask the same question about the climate and climate change and what humans or beings are doing regarding the climate. I think it's part of the same argument that indeed what's happening with spillover is that as our industrial world expands more and more and engulfs and affects more and more of the environment, we are systematically destroying animal habitat by deforestation. Above all, I'm thinking of mining companies, logging companies, palm oil companies are really good examples of that. And as they destroy this habitat, we as a species are brought into ever more frequent and contact with animals that are reservoirs for a variety of diseases that can be transmitted to humans, but that humans have no immunity against because we hardly, if ever, encountered them in the past. And that's the story. So the spillover, zoonotic diseases of animals, is what David Quammen was talking about, are increasingly affecting human beings because of the way that we've dealt with the natural environment around us. And so we see, going back to avian flu or Ebola and MERS, SARS, and now COVID-19 are all the result of spillovers from animal species in the sense of the disease we're fighting at the moment, this coronavirus, originated in bats. Bats are not affected by their reservoir for this disease. They aren't themselves affected by it. But when it's transmitted to a human being, the disease becomes what we now know as COVID-19. And so it's this frequency, this increasing frequency of these events that is very much with us. And we haven't heard the end of this story, I feel quite certain. And I agree with David Quammen that this was an event that people had been forecasting for a very long time. One of the most poignant questions of this COVID-19 so far was the question asked by President Trump, who could have known at an early stage of this? And I think my answer would be, like David Quammen's, that actually everyone should have known, because scientists had been saying that this was inevitable ever since 1997, that is a quarter of a century.
Right, because of the changing, what we're doing to the environment, what we're doing, the bats have been displaced by the logging.
That's exactly right.
It's a very physical, concrete thing that's happening. It's not just germs in the air.
No, as someone said on television recently, this is, in fact, nature's response to what human beings are doing to it.
We are talking about, and it's so easy to just say the title of the book, Epidemics in Society, From the Black Death to the Present. It's a 2019 book. It's now out in paperback with a new preface on the novel Coronavirus. My guest is the author, Frank Snowden. He's professor emeritus of history of medicine at Yale University and author of the book, as I said. If you have a question or comment for Professor Snowden, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Pandemics such as COVID-19 have played a critical role in shaping the course of human society, influencing politics, art, science, and just about everything else. Frank Snowden is professor emeritus of history and history of medicine at Yale University. He's written a book about all that. It's titled Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. The book is now out in paperback with a new preface to address the novel coronavirus. Thanks again for joining us, Professor Snowden.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Most of us have grown up thinking and being told we have the greatest healthcare system in the world. We have the greatest this, we have the greatest that. And yet the United States has missed the boat when it comes to addressing this particular coronavirus. I'm wondering if there are other examples out there of sort of, there's a word I'm thinking of, and it's sort of a conceit about our health system that gives us an undeserved sense of security.
Yes, I do believe that one of the reasons we were so unprepared was a sort of hubris that we are not, as a society, vulnerable to these events, that epidemic diseases are something of the past, and we're protected by bulwarks of science, bulwarks of our healthcare system, as all the things, the wonderfully trained doctors, the NIH, the CDC, all of those are protections indeed. On the other hand, the reason that we were caught so unprepared was that we had been actually not organizing in a way to make use of the resources that we have, to make use of the science that we have. We have a very fragmented healthcare system, and therefore the messaging was fragmented. We have the president and the White House saying one thing to the American public as the epidemic began. The president's advisors saying something different. 50 governors all saying something else. County governments, mayors of cities, school boards. So there was a cacophony of, and so people were confused. And we also, so that was a major factor. In addition, before reaching this level, we had systematically underfunded our response capabilities. I think that we're, for example, take our hospital system. We have wonderful hospitals, but because health is regarded as on the profit basis, hospitals are run in such a way that there is no surge capacity built into them. So we didn't have enough beds, enough ventilators. That was enough trained personnel, enough protective equipment. And so these wonderful hospitals were not equipped to deal with a sudden mass emergency. In fact, we deal better with our financial system since the Great Depression, that banks are required to have surge capacity of spare funds in the event of a run on the currency. But we haven't done that with our hospital system. We don't have that kind of capacity to expand. We also underfunded the CDC, the world's premier emergency response agency, has been cut back and back again and again over recent years. And science has been very much a matter of debate in our country. And that has also been a major factor in undermining our preparedness to deal with this crisis. So my comment would be that America was not well served by this attitude and the structure of fragmentation. And I can see a contrast with the way the country I'm living in the minute, which is Italy,
yeah,
which responded in a different way, partly because, and it was also terribly affected, but there was this major difference that there was not a fragmentation. There was one authority. The state had one message for the Italian public that we're all in this together, that we have only one way of fighting it, which is social distancing. And if we want to protect our country, if we want to protect ourselves, our families, our communities, this is what we have to do. This is how we can help ourselves. And posters went up. Television gave this message every day at night. Vans went through neighborhoods proclaiming the message. And so there's been a remarkable lack of objection to the policies, even though the lockdown was fiercer and longer than in the United States. And that's been extraordinary to witness and see. And in fact, the local newspaper in Rome said that something extraordinary was happening. That is, in 3,000 years of the history of the city of Rome, this is the very first time that Romans were obedient. And I think that one can see that, and that makes such a striking contrast for the confusion and chaos that has gone on across the waters, even though the United States has so much more in the terms of resources and equipment that could be potentially mobilized, but wasn't mobilized to deal with this crisis.
Let's see. Chris and Galena, you're on the air with Professor Frank Snowden. Hi, Chris.
Hi. When I think about the 1918 pandemic and what I've read and about it, I started thinking about how it might have impacted like the Roaring Twenties that came right after it. And there were so many changes in like culture and industry with automobiles and electricity and politics with the women's right to vote. What part did the pandemic play in those changes? And then if it was significant, what might we expect to see in the decade after this pandemic is over?
Yes, right. That's a challenging and interesting question. I think I would say that the Roaring Twenties probably didn't have much to do with the pandemic of disease. The only kind of very loose linkage one can see was the Roaring Twenties being a time of wishing to put aside anxieties and concerns, of which I think the war was the greatest, the problems of the peacemaking also. And I think the pandemic was very far behind. People by the 20s had already put it very much outside their minds. And that leads me to the second part of your question, which is what changes might one expect. I would argue that except in the field of public health, public health personnel never forgot the pandemic of 1918. It was the general population that forgot. And it was therefore, one would say, that the pandemic didn't have major societal changes in its that it left as its legacy for the future. And I think that's going to be very different. I think the 1918 model won't help us to an anticipating what might help what happened to us with COVID-19. The 1918 pandemic, remember, went away. I think that COVID-19 is going to be with us for a very long time. People from the World Health Organization have said today that it might indeed become an endemic disease, and that we'll have to, not that it's going to be the end of the world or the apocalypse, no, far from it, but meaning that we're going to have to learn and adjust our behavior to deal with it in the future. So I expect being besieged for a prolonged period by a disease of this kind, we'll have to have changes in how we do our business, work being transformed. It already has been. There'll be a lot more telecommuting, working from home. We'll also need to imagine our cities in different ways, where there mass transportation by bus and by subway. We'll see won't be occurring. There'll be staggered work so that there isn't this great rush hour with people crammed together. Our recreational, religious activities will have to be done with social distancing. This way that pavements and sidewalks will need to be much broader so that people can keep distance from each other. So I think there'll be very profound changes. I doubt that handshaking and embracing friends will come back so very quickly. So I think we're going in little and profound ways, the way that we work, the way that we play, the way that we carry out our recreational activities, how restaurants operate, how we relate to the healthcare system and medicine. There'll probably be a lot more telemedicine as there has been during this period. And I think those are changes that aren't going to go away, that will remain with us as we adapt to living and containing this this major long-term challenge.
Thank you, Chris, for that call. Anybody else? The number is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You mentioned end of the world, and you do start your pandemic timeline in the 14th century with the Black Death, the most fatal pandemic in recorded human history. It was like an end of times scenario, right?
Oh yes, this was people. One often sees discussions of COVID-19 as something that's unprecedented, and I would say that it pales in comparison with what happened during the Black. Doesn't mean it's not serious, mm-hmm. but it's not on a scale. The Black Death was a different order of magnitude. magnitude is the word I'm trying to say, so that it had a much more profound effect. It killed half the population of Europe. It led to the first Holocaust, in that the early years of the Black Death witnessed this tremendous surge of anti-Semitism and pogroms in France, in the Rhineland, in northern Italy, as the Jews were blamed for attacking Christendom and poisoning the wells, and the idea that they wanted to end Christianity. And so there were this Jews were rounded up by authorities and taken to courts, tortured, and they confessed, and then they were put to the death by fire or by the sword by authorities across Europe at the time. That was a major impact. Another impact, of course, was the development of public health. If a Florentine from the 15th century were able to climb into a time machine and miraculously visit us today, they would see that a lot of the policies that we're applying had been developed in the Renaissance to deal with bubonic plague. Social distancing isn't new. Lockdowns aren't new. Quarantine is, in fact, an Italian word from that period. Flight. Is not new. We know that 500,000 people fled New York City in the time of coronavirus, and much happened during European cities during time of bubonic plague. Protective PPE, that is personal protective equipment, the sort of space suits that healthcare providers wear, that's also not new. There were masks in Renaissance Florence or Venice. There were long gowns. There were long rods that healthcare workers held to urge patients and other people to keep a distance from them. And so we see quarantines, lockdowns, and all of those features are actually the legacy of the bubonic plague, but not, we don't expect to see a total collapse of the economy, half the people of the world dying as a result of this. So that really did feel a lot like Armageddon. And it's interesting that in his great film, The Seventh Seal, Bergman, the Swedish producer, it's a film of 1957, which is trying to imagine what would happen in a nuclear holocaust. And the closest he can come to that is the bubonic plague. And so it's a film about bubonic plague and what happened then. But what he's really thinking about is the world in the wake of a nuclear holocaust. Well, I would argue that coronavirus, as horrible as it is, and with all the suffering, all of the sacrifice, the economic ruin that it's creating, and so many people dying, is nonetheless not of a to be measured in the scale of bubonic plague, which was something, and also the bubonic plague began in 1347 and didn't depart again after a whole series of waves, and for 400 years in Western Europe. The last event was in 1734. So that was an extraordinary, lengthy series of waves of this terrible disease. It was different.
If it broke out again now, would our technology, would our scientific advancements give us any cover?
Well, that's interesting to raise as a question, because we think that bubonic plague so often has gone away, that it's a medieval affliction. In fact, it's never gone anywhere. There are animal reservoirs of bubonic plague, and around the world, when people come into contact with creatures like prairie dogs that are its reservoirs, they catch bubonic plague today. And about 3,000 people every year around the world die of it, including about 20 or so. It's a trickle of cases in the southwest of the United States, places like New Mexico and Arizona, where the prairie dogs do still have bubonic plague. And if for example, people come with pet dogs and the pet dogs are off the leash and they come into contact with the prairie dogs. They have an exchange of fleas. And if that person with the dog then goes back to a motel or hotel and leaves a supply of fleas there when they depart, then the next person is vulnerable. And indeed, I have a friend who caught bubonic plague in Arizona by precisely this way. But then in terms of protection, the bubonic plague is extremely deadly. Unlike another difference from coronavirus is that something like 50, 60% of untreated cases of bubonic plague, people die of the disease. That's not true of COVID-19, thank God. But this meant that it is a tremendous emergency if one catches bubonic plague. But unlike COVID-19, we have modern antibiotics, and they are capable of treating bubonic plague. So if it's caught early, that's the big caveat. It needs to be caught early. But if it is caught early, then people can be successfully treated in the vast majority of cases. So we do actually have a weapon against the plague in the way that we don't yet have against COVID-19.
You know, as far as the bubonic plague goes, how did it change how people related to the major institutions of the day? I suppose government and church?
Yes. The government, absolutely, because the mechanisms that were used to deal with this involved the creation of centralized authorities. That is, they were called healthcare magistrates. We'd call them boards of health. And they had emergency powers, and those included the power of taxation. If you're going to set up hospital centers, administer them, provision the patients and the staff, if you're going to provide them with protective equipment even, if you're going to quarantine ships and crew and cargo for 40 days, you need to have police powers. You need to have all to feed and provision them as well. If you're going to have lockdowns, you have to have, again, the means of enforcing those. So yes, this did involve a centralization of power. And so I would regard the emergence of the early modern state with its enormous powers to protect, among other things, citizenry. That's partly a legacy, or let's say it was molded by the bubonic plague. So our relationship with the state changed as a result. The position with regard to religion and the arts, one would say that the bubonic plague had an enormous impact because one of the worst things at the time was the fear of sudden death, which was represented most of all by bubonic plague. You could be stricken in a public place and die very rapidly from this terrible affliction. And you could do so without having your spiritual affairs in order. And so one of the great concerns was sudden death, which was threatened your whole relationship with God and your eternal salvation. And so we can see this addressed in the art across all of Europe, where the major themes are reminding people, it's called a memento mori, a reminder of death. And so the iconography is that paintings would have enormous numbers of metaphors, should we call them, reminding people that this life isn't the real thing. We must prepare for the afterlife, which endures forever. And so you see skull and crossbones. You see the hourglass with the sands running out, flowers starting to wilt, a candle that's about to be snuffed out. All of that is a big part of the art and the religion of the period. You also see there are enormous upsurge in the plague saints who were willing, it was thought, to intercede with God to bring this horrible affliction to an end. And these were the Virgin Mary, Saint Roch, and Saint Sebastian. And so you see those three saints in particular portrayed in enormous numbers by the artists of the period. There are the whole museums today of the centuries from the 15th through the 18th are filled with paintings of Saint Sebastian and the Virgin and Saint Roch. Cathedrals were built to honor them. There are plague statues all across every city of Central Europe, Vienna and every place else in Central Europe. So we see this enormous upsurge in religiosity. There was also a dark side in the early years, and that was the idea that this was a punishment from God, and only by repentance could we be saved. And therefore, there was a hunt on for those who were the flagellants, particularly the movement. These are people who went around for 40 days. We see that number coming up. Mm-hmm. They went in procession in penitence and beating themselves with whips and beating the other people on the procession with whips. And then often, if they came across foreigners or Jews, they would turn upon them and beat them and kill them. So this was a very violent response, and it was done in the name of a kind of, shall we call it, a pseudo-religion, this hunting for the unclean. It's a kind of ethnic cleansing. Prostitutes were thought to be also the guilty party, and so one sees a turning on prostitutes, and they're being evicted from cities and also beaten and sometimes burned as witches during this period. So religion manifested itself in a whole variety of different ways. Upsurge of religiosity. I also believe this is something that we'll need to think about in our own time, which is a crisis of faith. People began to wonder what kind of divinity can this be that is omniscient and all-powerful, and yet allows something like this to happen. And people were under profound psychological stress as everyone around them is dying, as they see the economy collapsing, hunger, the collapse of law and order. And so I do believe that there was enormous post-traumatic stress, although they didn't call it that at the time. Mm-hmm. And this took its, some people became, I think, a crisis of faith, not atheism, that was anachronistic at that time, but strong religious doubt was a part of the feature of this time. And I think if you look for this kind of landscape, I mentioned the Bergman film, but going back to a contemporary accounts, I think you could read Shakespeare's life was marked by plague. Stratford-on-Avon, when he was born, and had an enormous outbreak. So friends and neighbors were talking about it. When he moved to London as a playwright and actor, there were waves of plague year after year, and the theater was shut down for periods. And I think the late plays of Shakespeare present this. I'm thinking of King Lear or Macbeth as would be wonderful examples of this sort of spiritual wasteland by someone who's seen plague repeatedly. Yeah. And this is, I think, akin to the spirit that motivated Bergman in The Seventh Seal. So I think it deeply affected religion and the arts throughout this period.
We'll continue our conversation. My guest is Frank Snowden, Professor Emeritus of History and History of Medicine at Yale and author of the book Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Well, Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Pandemics such as COVID-19 have played a critical role in shaping the course of human society, influencing politics, art, science, and so much more. Frank Snowden is professor emeritus of history and history of medicine at Yale University. He's written a book about that. The 2019 book is now out in paperback. It's titled Epidemics and Society from the Black Death to the Present. And it has a new preface to address the novel coronavirus. Frank Snowden, you mentioned, you know, it's several times now the propensity for humans to want to blame somebody for these outbreaks over time. It's somebody's fault. That's, again, nothing new to hear, say, President Trump railing against the World Health Organization or China. What do you make of that? And is it just a natural human inclination? And does it serve any purpose?
I think it is. I believe that we see these pandemics also as a kind of moral drama being enacted in front of us with our dark sides and our light sides. And I think that there is in a tendency among human beings, we require some sort of explanation for what's happening. We want to know, how is this affliction occurring? And there's a temptation then to succumb to a simple explanation that it's somebody's fault. That's not a scientific explanation, but it is a recurring tendency. We see in HIV/AIDS the blame against homosexuals. We were talking about blaming Jews, prostitutes, foreigners with the plague. This is a very current problem, as we know, that across Europe, there's been on the right of the political spectrum, there are nationalist politicians who say, in defiance of all scientific evidence, that the problem is caused by immigrants. And immigration is the problem. And if we closed our borders, it would no longer be the case. And there was a wild hunt in northern Italy at the outset of this coronavirus for the so-called patient zero, who was thought to be the immigrant who brought the disease to Italy. It turned out not to be the case at all, but that was the spirit of the thing. And similarly, in Germany, in the Netherlands, in France, Le Pen argues that this is the fault of immigrants. And we see across large parts of Asia and Europe, even before coronavirus arrived, that Chinatowns were deserted and people even posted signs, Chinese not welcome here. Well, then in the United States, we see this upsurge with the disease being called by President Trump, a Chinese refusing to call it COVID-19, saying we must call this, it's a foreign disease that's invaded, and it's a disease, the Chinese virus, the Wuhan virus, and the response of that. Now we're stirring very deep, dark parts of the American psyche. We think back of the history in relationship to Asiatic peoples with the Chinese Exclusion Act, and then the rounding up and of Japanese people for internment camps during World War II. So that is part of our history, and this is being stirred up. And people are, in some cases, reacting to it by thinking that it's true. And so there are attacks on Asiatic people, not even necessarily Chinese people, but people who look Chinese from Korea or from Vietnam, and children of Asiatic origin being attacked in schoolyards. And one hears that Chinese and Asiatic people in New York City were afraid to ride the subway alone, lest they be insulted or spat upon or physically assaulted. And so they arranged to travel in groups. And Dr. Tedros, the Director General of the World Health Organization, said that there was an epidemic along with the pandemic of COVID-19. There was another pandemic of fear, misinformation, paranoia, and stigmatization that was complicating the job of public health workers, complicating it because if you think that is, if you argue that it is due to immigration, then the answer then is to close the borders. But microbes don't respect borders. And so devoting your resources in an unscientific way to that kind of issue diverts attention, resources away from the real problems of the society and therefore complicates the task of public health instead of making it easier. And so it's a very dangerous course to adopt ideas about physical reality that are in conflict with the way that medical science understands that reality. That undermines, puts the both hands of public health officials tied behind their backs. That's one of the great problems of stigmatization.
Right. When we take this approach, or when enough people do it, do we lose whatever sort of ancillary benefit may come from the pandemic?
Oh, I see. I think there are two things there. One is, do pandemics have a silver cloud lining in the dark cloud? Mm-hmm. And often they do. We've talked about the emergence of public health as a result to bubonic plague, of sanitation as a result to cholera and typhoid. And it's possible, quite possible, that with coronavirus, since nature is delivering us this very powerful message, that it will, over in the longer term, the medium and long term, cause us to make changes to our relationship with nature, with our relationship with each other, make changes in our healthcare system so that people don't fall between the cracks. All of those issues are ones, the way that we do our work and our entertainment, our life in our cities, all of those things are probably ancillary benefits, as you put it. And I do think that fixating upon a pseudo cause for the disease destroys accurate thinking about how to deal with the real problem, just as you wouldn't want to divert an engineer from building a bridge from gravity to deal with something else. Similarly, we wouldn't want to divert medical scientists from dealing with the virus itself, how it's disseminated, and trying to understand the truth of how it's disseminating, and say that no, actually, it's in the DNA of Asian people. That is will prevent us from having the benefit, the silver lining that could be in this dark cloud, and it also will therefore make the suffering and death longer and more numerous than it would have to be.
We've only got about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about our relationship with China and all of this, and how that could harm efforts to control the virus's spread going forward, because where it came from or where we know that it first was identified we're kind of at a war of words with them now.
And that's absolutely true, and it's tremendously dangerous for a variety of reasons, but public health is definitely one, because we are inescapably part of a global world, and something that happens anywhere happens everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so we rely on each other, and we need accurate information for China and from any other country where a new emerging disease first appears. The whole world, an alarm needs to sound, and we need to have international organizations to combat it. And so this war of words with China undermines that capacity, breaks down the trust between East and West. And also we see that the World Health Organization is being dragged into this. And I think that I agree the World Health Organization has made mistakes. We're human, we're all fallible. The World Health Organization made some important mistakes. But we need an organization like that. It's the only organization in the world that can take a really global perspective, tracking the disease, talking to health ministers around the world and providing guidance. It's a part of our survival kit. And so to throw out the baby with the bathwater by underfunding or even getting rid of the World Health Organization would be a tragedy and make us much less prepared in the future for dealing with other emergencies. And so, yes, absolutely, the War of Worlds with China can have a lot of collateral damage that will profoundly affect our health going forward.
Professor Snowden, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Frank Snowden is a professor emeritus of history and history of medicine at Yale and author of the 2019 book Epidemics and Society, From the Black Death to the Present. That's out in paper book now with a new preface that addresses the coronavirus. Thank you so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.